and over. You certainly don't look it. He ground to a halt and encircled her with his arms. She tipped her head up to his, and they kissed for a long time. She no longer felt cold at all. She felt nothing but the heat of his mouth on hers. They could hear a group of girls approaching and slowly pulled away from each other. He looked her in the eye in a way that made her feel as though no one had ever really seen her before, as though he knew her better than she knew herself. What did he see when he looked at her that way? Surely it wasn't the country girl who had taken the bus to Oak Ridge 3 months ago. She wanted to be the girl he saw, and the thought that she was thrilled her. "You'd better eat something before your shift starts," he whispered. She nodded, and they turned back to the cafeteria, hand in hand. They passed the laughing group of girls who watched June, wondering, she knew, how a girl like her had attracted a man like that. "They don't know," she thought. "They can't see the June that Sam sees." It was growing dark now, the electric lights of the town twinkling before them. She wondered what he was thinking, but didn't ask. He could have his own thoughts, and she could have hers. What mattered was that they were together. It was in these quiet moments that she felt herself overwhelmed with a feeling she had never known before that she could identify only as love. It was a simultaneous sense of contentment and aching for something more, joy heightened almost to sadness as she watched him, wanting him, loving him, desperate for him, praying he felt the same way. Because she had begun spending so many evenings with Sam, she found it impossible to hide their relationship from Cece. On about their fourth date, she mentioned it casually when her roommate asked where she was headed. June was on her way out the door, all made up, and Cece was just coming home after the evening shift. There was an edge of hurt to her voice, and June realized that she was behaving strangely. They used to spend almost every night together, after all. "I have a date," she said, watching for Cece's look of amazement. "With Sam Cantor." "Oh." Cece didn't try to hide her disapproval. "Well, I hope he doesn't drink tonight like he did on New Year's. We're just going to the movies. Have fun." Cece didn't sound as though she thought they would. June waved and dashed out the door. They never really talked about it again after that. Cece avoided asking June what she was up to when she went out. She was out most nights with Tom anyway, so it didn't much matter. June would have liked to have a friend to talk to about Sam. She longed to moon over him the same way Cece did over Tom, but she could tell her friend would not be receptive. So it remained her special secret life. She was overflowing with secrets these days, her secret love affair, secret feelings, secret hopes, and, of course, the secret that could get her and Sam thrown out of Oak Ridge altogether. The secret of the atomic bomb. June Walker crept up on Sam. The affair began spontaneously and was certainly motivated by lustful animalistic instincts. That had been surprising enough, and at first he'd worried about leading her on, hurting her. But what was more shocking was his own desire day after day to see her. As the fog of his bodily desires began to lift, he realized that he enjoyed her company. In a simple way he wasn't sure he'd ever experienced before, her presence made him happy. Not only was he attracted to her, but he liked her. She was kind and thoughtful. He had trusted her almost immediately and felt comfortable with her, too, as though he'd known her forever. He found himself daydreaming in the lab, looking forward to seeing her after work, even wondering what she was up to at odd hours, like a love-struck boy. It was awfully embarrassing. She was innocent and ignorant, true, but she had an insatiable appetite for learning. He could keep her attention for hours when they were safe in the privacy of his bedroom at Charlie and Anne's. His lectures would go on almost uninterrupted, save for her questions and occasional kisses. It didn't matter if he was explaining nuclear physics or his family's history in Europe. She was endlessly interested. She was clearly infatuated, but also deeply curious, not just about him, but about Oak Ridge and physics and the whole world outside of East Tennessee. Sam enjoyed playing tutor, more than he'd like to admit. Talking to June was something altogether different than standing by a blackboard in front of bored undergraduates, though he was aware that she was just as young as his students back in California. It wasn't just their physical intimacy that heightened the experience. She was a blank slate. Her mind was free of all but the most basic physical science she had learned in her backwoods high school, and she trusted him implicitly. She was a completely supportive audience and loyal pupil. Her eager young mind was in his hands to develop as he wished. She had opinions of her own, yes, but in these areas about which she knew so little, he found that they soon conformed to his own. He couldn't help but recognize how much he enjoyed the power, how heady it was to have such subtle control over another person. He told her the truth, the hard scientific facts, but of course even science could be explained to suit certain purposes, and his lessons were always peppered with commentary on his colleagues, the war, and the government. He spoke his opinions freely. He explained that in the beginning he had felt a strong sense of purpose to build the bomb before the Germans. Most American physicists had felt this purpose, in particular the many recent immigrants from Europe, mostly Jews, who had been forced to flee Nazism. Perhaps in the face of such an undeniably evil enemy, though, they had become overly self-righteous. They thought of themselves as heroic, as doing the right thing, but he was becoming increasingly ambivalent. How could a weapon of such power be the right thing? How could more killing, undoubtedly, of civilians be heroic? She was solemn, nodding, and watching him closely with her big gray eyes. He had to give her credit. She was independent-minded enough to follow his thinking past the patriotic propaganda that surrounded them to the bigger picture of how atomic weapons could change or, God forbid, destroy the world. He enjoyed spilling out his thoughts to her, holding her warm body against his, the sympathy of her mind and touch. He felt he was helping her, that with his help, June would be transformed for the better. After all, only a few months ago, she had been destined to be a farmer's wife in the middle of nowhere. Already, he had opened her mind to ideas she could never have dreamed before. She was transforming him in her own way, as well. He hadn't bothered buying Homer's moonshine in a month. He was spending more and more time with June, and he knew she didn't like to see him drink too much. Besides, with her there, he didn't feel the need to be drunk to enjoy himself. She was distraction and entertainment enough. They certainly didn't spend all their time talking about physics. It was impossible for him to stay focused on any topic for more than 15 or so minutes before the impulse to touch her became too great. They'd start necking, sitting chastely beside each other on his bed, then move on to heavier petting as arms became involved and clothes removed. A few weeks passed before they made love for a second time after that first frenzied encounter. It was difficult to find the privacy, for one thing. He wasn't allowed into June's dorm, and obviously he couldn't let on to Charlie and Anne that he was having his way with a teenage girl in their house. The first Saturday June was working the night shift, and Charlie and Anne would be gone for the day, he shamelessly invited her over, and they spent the afternoon together, naked for the most part, in bed. He remembered that he had once found her plain, and it surprised him how attractive she had become to him. It was true that she did not possess the glamour of her roommate, that she lacked striking Hollywood-style good looks. Her face was expressive, though, her features delicate, the set of her jaw firm. He found her most beautiful when all her makeup was off. The natural fleshy pink of her lips aroused him, and her face without makeup was almost more naked than her body without clothes. Seeing her without lipstick was truly intimate. He knew no other man got to see those soft lips nude. And pretty quickly, he gave up worrying about the morality of the whole thing and flung himself into the affair. The one worry that they both shared was getting pregnant. June seemed to have no qualms about sleeping with him, other than the fact that she realized having his baby could be disastrous. He reassured her that he would do his best to prevent this, which mostly meant finding creative ways to avoid climaxing inside her. He didn't want to ruin this poor girl's life. Max was the only person he could talk to about it, and even with him, it was only in vague terms. It didn't take his friend long to notice that Sam had found someone else to spend his time with. Max took a certain pride in the relationship. "I told you," he said when Sam first confessed the affair over beers in the canteen. I told you to get a girlfriend, and look, you went right out and did it. I had no idea you took my advice so seriously. But I must insist you name your firstborn after me. I'd prefer to avoid procreating at this point. Fair enough. Well, mate, now I'm going to have to follow my own advice, aren't I? If you're off at the roller rink half the time with your girl, with whom shall I despise the world? Max treated the whole thing with good-natured mockery. Talking to Charlie and Anne about it was another matter. Anne had wanted to know every last detail after that first date. He spoke casually, but they noticed the amount of time he was spending out with her. Dinners at home became friendly interrogations. Sensing that they might not fully approve of June's pedigree, Sam gave short, vague answers, but Anne was persistent, and soon decided that June must come to dinner. Sam knew June was nervous. It was charming, the way she giggled for no reason as he told her a bit about Anne and Charlie on the way to dinner. They were holding hands, walking along the boardwalk. Charlie is the nicest guy I've ever met. He was everybody's favorite at Princeton. Always hosting parties, always buying rounds of drinks. Finding out he was here was a lifesaver when I first arrived. June giggled.
Where are they from?
Boston.
And they're both your age?
Yes, we're all terribly old.
No, no. I'm terribly young.
You're lovely.
He had to stop talking and walking momentarily to kiss her. When they finally pulled apart, Sam repeated,
"You are lovely, June Walker, and I'm sure they will love you."
When they walked into the house, Charlie greeted them in the living room. He shook June's hand vigorously, and she giggled. Sam wished that tonight of all nights they could drink with dinner. He lit a cigarette instead. He and June sat on the sofa, Charlie across from them.
"So, June, you grew up around here?"
"Yes, over near Maryvale."
"And your family has a farm?"
She nodded.
"What do you grow?"
Sam found it touching that Charlie was trying so hard.
"Oh, a little of everything. Corn and wheat, mostly. And we have cattle, of course."
"That must have been a lovely way to grow up, surrounded by nature."
Before June could answer, Anne appeared from the kitchen. She was perfectly dressed, as usual, in a navy suit and apron.
"Hello, June."
Anne shook June's hand as well. "It's so nice to finally meet you."
"You too."
June's voice was soft, and Sam hoped she was holding up. The evening had only just begun.
"If you're all ready to eat, we can move to the table."
Anne had gone all out and set the table with the fancy lace tablecloth and candles. She brought out pork chops with some sort of spicy applesauce, green beans, roasted potatoes, and rolls. As usual, her food and its presentation were excellent. She pulled off every dinner party despite rationing. In fact, Sam suspected she enjoyed showing off her ability to work around the rations. She even saved her leftover cooking fat for the Boy Scouts, who had regular drives in Oak Ridge to collect fat for war glycerin production. The perfect picture of a wartime housewife.
"So, how did you two meet, anyway?"
Charlie asked, piercing beans with his fork.
"We work in the same place," Sam said.
Charlie smiled.
"And, of course, you can't say any more than that. Are you enjoying working in Oak Ridge, June?"
"Oh, yes, it's great fun here. I miss my family, of course, but there's so much to do, things I could never have imagined on the farm."
Anne nodded sympathetically.
"But you must have been here much longer than me. How do you find living here?"
"Oh, besides the mud?" Anne laughed. She went on in a hesitant tone.
"We like it. It was a big change for us, too, and when we got here, things were much more primitive than they are now. It seems like a fun place for a young person, though."
"Well, we have fun, too," Charlie said. "Anne and I are on a bowling team."
"And I sing in a choir."
"And you have your women's group."
"I find people here very open. You know, they're from all over, all backgrounds, and everyone seems so ready to reach out and make friends, experience new things."
"You make it sound like summer camp,"
Sam said, shoveling potatoes onto his plate.
"Well, in some ways it is."
"Yes, top secret wartime summer camp."
Anne rolled her eyes at him and turned back to June.
"So, you grew up on a farm, June?"
Sam winced to hear the conversation returning to this old material, but June managed to get through all right. She seemed to relax as the meal went on, and by the time Anne brought out apple pie, she'd completely stopped giggling. The good thing about dinner without drinks was that there was no excuse to linger when it was over, so Sam was able to initiate the goodbyes and usher her out the door without too much fuss. At first, they walked toward her dorm in silence. Finally, June spoke.
They're very nice.
Yes, they are nice people.
The food was delicious.
Man's a great cook. I hope you weren't on the spot too much there.
Oh, no, I just hope they liked me.
Of course they liked you.
And again, he had to stop talking and walking momentarily to kiss her neck. Anne had gone on to bed when Sam got back, but Charlie was in the living room, smoking and reading. He looked up as Sam walked in and slammed his book shut.
Jeez, lovely, Sam. I think you make a swell couple.
Thanks, Charlie. He took off his coat and sat across from his friend, settling back into the sofa and lighting his own cigarette.
You know, I have no idea what I'm doing.
Well, she makes you happy, right? That's the most important thing. Charlie settled back into the sofa, as if to indicate that he had issued his judgment on the matter, and that was that. It was a few days before Sam heard Anne's judgment. It was early evening, and Charlie was out. She had made tea for the two of them, and they were listening to the news bulletin on the radio. Sam turned it off when the news finished, and a Western came on.
Are you meeting June tonight?
She asked.
No, she's on the night shift. I'll see her for breakfast.
So, it's quite serious between you two, isn't it?
Sam shrugged, already not liking where this was going.
I mean, you spend an awful lot of time together.
Anne's tone was not altogether pleasant.
She's a sweet girl.
Anne said nothing, but raised an eyebrow. Sam, who had hardly ever had a negative thought about Anne, found himself becoming angry.
What?
Nothing.
It seems like there's something you want to say.
Anne spoke carefully.
She's very young.
She's 18.
Are you planning on marrying her?
I don't know. We hardly just met.
Anne clenched her jaw for a moment, then spoke quickly.
This is quite a job, you know. Being the wife of a professor or a researcher, there is entertaining to be done, people you have to know how to impress and talk to. Do you think she's prepared for this life? Has she had the adequate education?
Sam saw what she was getting at. He instantly recoiled at her snobbery, though of course he had had similar thoughts about June from the beginning.
She's smart, Anne. I've been teaching her science, and I'll venture she understands more about physics than you now.
That may very well be true. But does she know how to discuss Freud or Trotsky at a dinner party? Look, Sam, I like her. I wouldn't be saying this if I didn't like her. Then I would just let you go on and do what you wanted.
Anne's cheeks were flushed. The effort of this aggression, so unnatural to her, was clearly painful. She continued in a softer voice.
She's clearly in love with you. When you make a young girl fall in love with you, you have certain obligations to her. Especially if...
She recoiled as though the phrase were lemon juice in her mouth.
You take her to bed.
Now that she had got it out, Anne looked proud and defiant. Sam felt too violated by this intrusion into his private life to think hard about what she was saying.
If that's all, I think I'm going to go out for a walk now.
He walked for 20 minutes before the black rage lifted enough for him to begin to think straight.
How dare she? How dare she?
He went over and over her words. The nerve of it. He was a grown man, and she was not his mother. She had no right to speak to him like that. Who he took to bed was his business, though he did worry how she had known that. Did she know for sure, or had she just made the assumption? Had he not been quiet enough when June was over? It was too horrible to think about for long, so he returned to hating Anne. Privileged, perfect Anne. She'd been born knowing who Freud was, no doubt. She'd never done anything inappropriate in her life, and now felt compelled to pounce on him for this one possible folly. Charlie was such a good guy. Charlie didn't judge him. Who did she think she was? Inevitably, he wound up at the canteen. Max wasn't there, so he drank by himself, stewing in his own anger. His sense of having been wrongfully accused, overwhelming enough that he didn't stop for a moment to consider that she might be right.
Chapter 13.
With spring came winds that swept hazy clouds of dust through town. Anything left outside quickly became coated with it, and children wrote messages in the windows of parked cars with their fingers. You couldn't walk a block without getting covered in a fine film of red dirt, and Cece had learned the hard way not to attempt wearing anything white. Nevertheless, Tom had been so insistent that she agreed to go on a walk. Some dirt in her eyes was a small sacrifice. After all, Cece had found her husband. Tom hadn't proposed yet, but she felt confident that he would soon. Married soldiers couldn't live with their wives in Oak Ridge anyway, so there was no need to tie the knot yet. But the boy was crazy for her, and was he ever a catch? Tom was handsome, in a lanky way, with sandy hair and a long face. His father managed a bank, and when he reminisced about his childhood, he casually tossed off sentences like, "My sister fell off her pony," "The cook had forgotten the sugar," or "It was my last summer at our Newport house." He was bitter that the war had meant that he hadn't gotten to spend the summer before he went to Yale and Europe, as his older brother had. The big worry, of course, was that he would see through her fake pedigree. But she had gotten by so far with vague answers about her background, and Tom seemed to assume, like most everyone else, that she was a Southern belle. No one wanted to think a pretty girl was poor. She told him that she was an orphan, which solved the problem of her parentage. His questions had led to the invention of an aunt who had raised her, Aunt Fay, whom Cece had become used to casually referencing in conversation, until Fay almost didn't seem like a lie. She implied that her family had once had money, but it had mostly been lost during the Depression. It was surprising how easily the stories came. "Father, rest his soul, wasn't a practical man," she heard herself saying as Tom helped her across a dried-up mud puddle. "I mean, I never got to know him myself, but that's what Aunt Fay always says. Bit of a dreamer. Always chasing after harebrained schemes, you know. I don't know the details, but I think he lost a pile in the crash."
"We did, too," said Tom.
Cece had to stop from rolling her eyes at the thought of all the money the poor Wolcotts had lost in 29, and then, no doubt, promptly made back.
"It's been a struggle for Aunt Fay, raising me on her own. That's why I thought I should come out here. I know I've been a financial burden to her. Oh, and also to serve my country, of course."
"Of course." Tom shielded her with his jacket as an especially dirty gust sprayed them with dust, and she gave a mock shriek.
"My hero,"
she laughed and pecked him on the cheek. Tom had led her away from home, over to the bowling alley. Cece knew he must be attempting a romantic gesture, but her fingers were growing numb and she kept slipping on the ice. Finally, he found the spot he was looking for, a nondescript patch of boardwalk in front of a bus stop. He held both her hands and gave her a big, goofy grin.
"Do you remember?"
"Remember what?"
"This place." Cece looked around. Sure, she'd been through here plenty of times before, but she didn't know why it might be important. He pulled her toward him and whispered in her ear, "Our first kiss."
"Oh, of course."
They'd left the bowling alley and lingered at the bus stop together. She remembered waiting impatiently for him to work up the nerve to finally kiss her.
"I love you, Cece Roberts."
He kissed her now without any caution. As he slowly pulled his face away from hers, he handed her a small box.
"Oh, Tom, how sweet."
She pulled at the fancy gold ribbon, ripped off the paper, popped it open, and saw a gleaming ruby pendant. It was gorgeous and looked expensive.
"It's beautiful."
"Not as beautiful as you."
He kissed her again, and she kissed him back enthusiastically. A man didn't buy jewelry like this for a lady unless he was serious. When she got back to the dorm that night, June was sitting up in her bed, reading, curlers in her hair. Cece worried about her roommate these days. She finally shown interest in a man, but it turned out she had terrible taste. Dr. Cantor was just awful, stuck up and strange, and he clearly drank too much. She couldn't imagine what June was thinking. Girl went out with him practically every night. Cece didn't mind so much, since she was usually with Tom, but she would at least invite June out with her and Tom's friends. June never invited her out with Dr. Cantor, not that Cece wanted to spend any time with him. What did they do together? What in the world did they talk about? June would just say they'd gone to the canteen or the movies, like it was the most natural thing. Cece found it revolting.
June looked up from her book.
Hello. Have a nice night.
Cece began unbuttoning her jacket to show off the necklace.
Look what Tom gave me. Wow, it's beautiful.
Cece beamed and sat down on her bed.
Did you go out with Dr. Cantor tonight? Oh, goodness, you have to start calling him Sam.
Cece scrunched her nose, not wanting to be any more intimate with him than she already was.
Yeah, we just went to the canteen. Tom took me to the spot where we first kissed and gave me the necklace. That's beautiful. I think Tom wants to marry me. Do you want to marry him?
Of course.
Well, that's wonderful.
June had put her book down on the bedside table and looked thoughtful.
Do you feel like you can tell Tom anything?
Anything important, she lied.
What about your job? Do you talk to Tom about what you do here?
Of course not. Don't be ridiculous.
You know that's illegal. You don't talk to Dr. Sam about it, do you?
June looked down, and Cece had the feeling she was lying. She was not as good at it as Cece.
No, of course not. I just wondered if you ever thought about it.
No.
Besides, I don't really want to talk about my job with Tom anyway.
She began taking off her boots. Honestly, June was getting odder and odder. Cece picked up her toiletry bag and started out the door to the restroom.
Oh, by the way, June said, the toilet down the hall is broken again.
That's the third time in a month.
I know, and there's the usual sign, an effort will be made to attend to the problem as quickly as possible.
It's ridiculous to climb up and down the stairs just to use the toilet.
And there's nothing we can do about it. Well, good night.
June turned off the light beside her bed. Cece put on her slippers and went into the hallway to walk down to the second floor. Someday she would live in a big house with a bathroom connected to her bedroom. She could walk in there naked if she wanted, but she would probably wear silk pajamas instead. Instinctively, she put her hand to her throat to feel that the pendant was still there. It was smooth and cool to the touch. Solid. June had suggested taking the bus to Norris Dam for a picnic, and Sam loved the idea. He told her he hadn't been out of Oak Ridge in a year. I feel like an inmate sprung from jail.
So silly. You could have done this any time by yourself.
The picnics by yourself aren't much fun. He kissed her cheek. They had sat in the back of the bus for privacy. It was sunny, and the trees were turning green. Each year, spring was a surprise to her. Of course she knew it would come again, but still, the coming always seemed a miracle. As the bus left the gates of the CEW under the watchful eye of the guard in the tower with his rifle, she squeezed Sam's hand. For the first time, they would be together in the outside world. The last time June had left had been Christmas. What would it be like to be headed to the farm instead of Norris? It was impossible to imagine Sam meeting her parents. They didn't know what physics was, really. They thought that the one Catholic family that had children in her school couldn't be trusted, so what would they make of a Jewish suitor for their daughter? And what would Sam make of them and the farm? She feared he would laugh at them, not openly, of course, but later to himself. It bothered her how he laughed at so many things, not because they were funny, but because he despised them. She doubted he realized she knew this about him. She wasn't even sure if he knew it about himself. They never would have met if it weren't for the CEW. And even if they had met somehow, what would they have had to say to each other? If he hadn't blurted out the horrible secret that first night, would they have ever even gone out on a date? But if they were to have a future, Sam would have to meet her parents one day. The future was constantly in June's mind these days. When she felt hopeful and in love, she daydreamed about being married in a house, their house. Able to do whatever they please, make love whenever they want. She would be in the kitchen, making his supper, while he was reading in his study. She'd never even been in a house with a study, but felt sure they'd have one. If she was feeling truly indulgent, she'd let a child scamper into the scene, a little girl with Sam's curls but her light eyes. She loved to imagine every last detail, what she was cooking, where they lived, how the house was decorated. She saw it all in cinematic glory, herself with perfect Ingrid Bergman hair and outfit,
The house, the sort she'd only ever seen in the movies, with open, sprawling rooms and a yard that was just for show, not for tending vegetables or animals. What was harder to imagine was how they would get there. The dam was situated on the side of a mountain, a huge swath of concrete holding back the water. The lake above the dam looked suspended in space, on a different level from everything below the huge man-made structure. It was unnatural and ungainly and spectacular. The government had taken people's land to build the dam, just as it had for Oak Ridge, and whole farms, once riverside, were now lake bottom. Now the dam generated the electricity that powered Oak Ridge. They found a spot to picnic by the lake, and June lay back, the grass prickling her skin. He was sitting with his elbow on one knee, watching her. The sun was warm on her face, and she closed her eyes. June? She was too lazy to open her eyes. Thank you. For what? Picnicking with me. He gently lifted her hand and stroked her palm. I love you, June. His tone was casual, but the words were the most momentous she'd ever heard. She kept her eyes closed, not wanting to move or speak or alter the moment in any way. The feel of his fingers on her palm seemed to send electrical shocks down her arm. It was dinner time by the time they got off the bus back in Oak Ridge, so they headed to the cafeteria together. As they approached the drugstore, June noticed a big group of people outside the door, and not in a line, just huddled together. Everyone was standing very still, listening to a radio turned up loud. Many of the women were crying. She edged closer to hear the announcer's words. In Warm Springs, Georgia, Franklin D. Roosevelt lies with the problems of this nation finally lifted from his shoulders, stricken late this afternoon with cerebral hemorrhage. June put her arm through Sam's and felt tears begin to well up. She thought Sam would laugh at her for crying, but his brow was furrowed. He squeezed her arm. The newsreader continued in his rhythmic cadence. Franklin D. Roosevelt, the first president to be elected to four terms in the White House, has passed away, and that is the overshadowing of all news events that have happened and can happen for a while. They stayed there in the crowd for some time. It was comforting to be surrounded by others feeling the same things, even if they were strangers. Finally, they continued on silently toward the cafeteria. It seemed disrespectful to eat dinner as though nothing had happened, but June was hungry. She filled her plate with spaghetti and paid the cashier. The girl took her money wordlessly, and June wondered if she'd heard the news. She looked for a seat and noticed Cece and Tom at a table by the windows looking out over the town site. Cece smiled and beckoned her over. June turned to get Sam's attention, and when she looked back at Cece's table, she was sure her friend's face had fallen. At once, June wished she had ignored Cece and eaten with Sam alone, but Sam was carrying his tray over to her, and there was nothing for it but to go sit with them. "So, have you heard the news?" asked June. "Yes. I heard on the radio at the dorm before coming over here," said Cece. "It's just awful," said June.
"He's been president for so long," added Tom. "I remember when he was the governor before that," said Sam, "when I was a kid in New York."
"That must have been a very long time ago," said Cece. "President Truman," June said. "It sounds strange."
"Well, let's hope he knows what he's doing."
Sam gulped his iced tea.
"Do you have to work tonight, June?" asked Tom.
"No, it's my day off."
"We were going to go roller skating. I don't know if you two are in the mood now, but you're welcome to join us."
Cece slammed her water glass down loudly, making it difficult for the others to pretend not to notice.
"Thanks for the offer, Tom," said Sam, "but I think we'll probably just go back to my place and listen to the radio."
"We took the bus to Norristan today, so it will be nice to relax this evening."
"That's fine," Cece said, picking up her fork once again and violently stabbing a piece of carrot on her plate.
"How was the dam?" asked Tom.
"Lovely," June replied.
A brief silence settled over the table, but Tom seemed determined to sustain a conversation.
"What exactly is cerebral hemorrhage?" he asked Sam, and Sam muttered a reply. "If these winds keep up, I don't know what we're going to do," he said to no one in particular, and no one responded. They finished quickly, parting ways with Cece and Tom, and started the walk back to Charlie and Anne's in silence.
The gusts of wind were making the spring evening colder than it should have been.
Finally, Sam spoke.
June, I have to say, I have no idea why you spend time with that girl. I know she's your roommate, but you don't have to hang around her.
She's not always like that.
June's voice was small and timid.
I should hope not. She strikes me as a real phony with that ridiculous way of talking.
She knew Sam had every right to be angry, yet June felt implicated by his criticism of her friend. She tried to explain.
Honestly, there's a whole other side to Cece, and I'm sorry she's so awful with you.
She's awful with you, too, from what I've seen. I don't mean to hurt your feelings. I'm just looking out for you. You don't have to spend time with a girl like that.
They walked in silence, interrupted only by the rustle of wind and the leaves. June couldn't explain Cece to Sam. These days she spent hardly any time with her, yet June wasn't ready to renounce their friendship completely. Cece was still fun, and heads still turned when they went out together. But there was more to her than that, and June suspected that she might be the only person who saw beyond the beautiful surface of Cece. Yeah, she acted proud, superior, rude. But June was sure that it was just that, an act. She saw Cece away from the cafeteria and bowling lanes and boys. In the dorm, when she didn't think anyone was looking, a different girl emerged. That Cece wore no makeup and had her hair in rollers. She looked vulnerable and tired, and her public bravado was replaced with an air of melancholy. When June finally got back to the dorm that night, Cece was already there, writing a letter at the desk they shared. She looked up and asked, "Have a nice evening?" "Oh, yes. Well, I mean, you know the news is awfully sad." Cece didn't reply. June knew better than to confide in her, but she couldn't help herself.
"Sam said he loved me today."
Cece's eyes widened, and she put down her pen.
"Oh? What did you say?" "Nothing. Do you think I should have said it back?"
"No, of course not."
"I think he knows I love him."
"Oh." Cece's voice was thick with disapproval. June sat on her bed, facing Cece. She felt reckless.
"Cece, you know you're my best friend. I wish you would give Sam a chance."
Cece said nothing and looked down at the piece of paper in front of her.
"I know he was awful on New Year's, but you must know that wasn't normal for him."
Cece faced her head on, her eyes empty, almost reptilian.
"A man like that is never going to marry you."
She picked up her pen and returned to her letter. June sat motionless for a moment before she realized she had to get out of the room. She hurried down the hall to the bathroom, struggling to keep tears from forming in her eyes. Chapter 14. As Joe wound up a 10-hour shift, he felt weary in every sense. His muscles tender, his mind exhausted by the tedium of performing the same tasks again and again. He didn't hear at first when the foreman called out his name. One of the other men had to give him a nudge.
"Follow me to my office," said the foreman.
His voice was gruff, though Joe knew by now that he always sounded that way. The foreman was heavyset, with a small head, so that his face looked as if it had been squeezed together to fit onto it. But he was efficient and fair, which was all Joe could want from him. Joe figured he was about to be let go. Most of the men on his construction crew had been laid off months ago. Trouble was, they'd finished building most of what needed to be built. Joe could hardly suppress his excitement at the thought of losing his job. In 2 days, he would be in Alabama again. He didn't know how in the world he'd keep his family fed and clothed, but they'd be together. The thought of it sent a warm tingle through his chest.
"Have a seat, Joe," said the foreman once they'd made it to his makeshift office, nothing more than a small hutment. "I'm sure you know that this job is winding up."
The foreman sat down across from Joe and pulled a box of cigarettes out of his shirt pocket. He extended the box toward Joe, who thanked him, and took one. The foreman took one as well, struck a match, and lit both cigarettes.
"I've had to send a lot of men home in the past month."
His voice was somber. He sucked on the cigarette and stared at the wall behind Joe.
"It's not a job I like, but what can you do? Construction here is almost done. Hell, I'll probably be sent home myself sooner or later."
The foreman chuckled, but Joe didn't know whether or not he should laugh. He took a drag from the cigarette.
Anyway, Joe, you're a first-rate worker, and don't think I haven't noticed.
Thank you, sir. I never seen you loafing on the job, and you're always first to volunteer for overtime. You're no spring chicken, Joe, but you work a hell of a lot harder than most of those young'uns out there.
Thank you.
He didn't know what else to say.
So, I've recommended to the Rowan Anderson Company that they keep you on in Oak Ridge. You're a valuable asset.
Joe was not quite sure what the man could mean.
Hey, construction may be over, but someone's got to clean all these buildings we just put up. You wouldn't consider janitorial work beneath you, would you?
No, sir.
Great, then you just need to go to the Hill tomorrow and talk to the Rowan Anderson folks about your new position.
Joe didn't say anything at first. The foreman looked confused.
You do want to stay in Oak Ridge, don't you?
Yes, sir. Only, do you think my wife could get a job here, too? I left her and my children down in Alabama, and I ain't seen them in almost 2 years.
The foreman stubbed out his cigarette in an ashtray.
I reckon that could be arranged. You just explain everything to them folks tomorrow, and if they give you any grief, tell them to speak to me.
Joe's face spread into a wide grin, and he shook the foreman's hand.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
Joe felt light and young and full of energy as he walked to the cafeteria. He could hardly wait to write to Mariah and tell her to get on the next bus to Tennessee. He was overcome with a sense that life was getting better and things were turning out the way they should. They would both be earning good government wages and the girls could go to school. Alabama, which just a few moments ago had seemed like a lost paradise, was now a place in the past. If he had his family here in Tennessee, then Oak Ridge would truly be his home. In the mess hall, he piled an extra helping of rice and beans on his plate, wanting to celebrate. He looked forward to sharing his good news with Ralph, but for now, stuffing his face would have to do. He sat and ate, and must have been smiling to himself, because he heard a woman say to him, "You look like you're in a good mood." He looked up, and Shirley was standing in front of him, holding her tray.
"I am, as a matter of fact."
His happiness was so expansive that he was glad to share it, even with Shirley. He motioned for her to sit, and she joined him. "Enjoying the spring weather?"
"Better than that. I just got some good news for myself. My wife gonna get a job here so she can join me."
"Oh, Joe, that is fantastic news." Shirley seemed genuinely happy for him. He let his smile take over his face.
"I can't tell you how much I miss my family."
"I can imagine. You have 2 children?
3. I can't believe I'll be seeing them soon."
"I'm so happy for you, Joe. Have you told Ralph yet?"
"No, I just found out myself."
"He'll be very pleased." Her face was warm and enthusiastic. Perhaps he'd misjudged Shirley. "What's your wife's name?"
"Mariah. She a good woman. Strong-willed, but kind."
"That's the best sort of woman," said Shirley, grinning slyly.
"I reckon you're right."
"I look forward to meeting her and the little ones." After supper, Shirley had to go to work, but sent Joe to the rec hall to celebrate with Ralph. Men and a few scattered women were playing checkers, cards, and dice, smoking and talking in the big barn-like room. In one corner, a man played the blues on a guitar, while a boy no older than 10 accompanied him on harmonica. The rhythmic wailing soared right up over the muffled sound of men's voices, and the room seemed to pulse to the beat of the song. Joe lit up a cigarette as he looked around for Ralph, careful not to look too hard at anyone. This room was full of men drunk on homemade whiskey, who would be eager for the slightest reason to start a fight. He'd known men like this all his life, though he'd tried to stay away from them. He never touched liquor himself, never put himself in a situation where a man's emotions could get the better of him.
"Joe!" Ralph called out to him. The boy was standing against the wall with Otis.
"What are you doing here?" asked Ralph.
"Oh, just came to relax a spell."
"Then you had the wrong place."
Otis smiled. Joe did not smile back. He wanted to share his news with Ralph, but not in front of Otis.
"They're gonna show a picture in an hour," said Ralph, who knew Joe liked the movies.
Otis laughed.
"Wouldn't count on it. Ain't no one gonna get this crowd to clear out for Cabin in the Sky."
I might play checkers," said Joe.
"I'll play with you," Ralph offered.
I don't mean to interrupt.
Otis shrugged.
I'm gonna play cards anyway.
Joe watched him walk away with relief and followed Ralph to an empty table where they set up the board.
I've been offered a new job.
Joe couldn't help but grin. Ralph looked surprised.
Doing what?
Janitor.
And they're gonna find a job for Mariah, too.
Well, ain't that something? Mariah, here in Oak Ridge.
I ought to get you a Coke to celebrate.
Don't waste your money.
No, I's getting you a Coca-Cola.
Ralph got up. Joe watched him go and wondered if the boy would be laid off soon. He didn't want his happiness to come at Ralph's expense. Ralph returned with two bottles of Coke, lids off. Joe leaned back for a big gulp and felt the pleasant sensation of the bubbles hitting the back of his throat. When he straightened up, he saw that Ralph was watching him.
How's that?
The boy asked.
Nice, said Joe. Real nice. You know, they may start allowing Negro couples to live together soon.
How you know?
Colonel Hodgson has instructed Rowan Anderson to work with us.
Why he want to help you?
Yes, Bob's letter to him worked.
Joe wiggled his brows skeptically.
Rowan Anderson be sending a representative to meet with us.
Really?
Yes, sir. They come into the CCC meeting tomorrow night.
Oh, it'd be real nice if I could live with Mariah and the children.
We'll make it happen.
Ralph sounded so calm and sure. Normally Joe would have laughed at his ideas, but he was in a hopeful mood, so he smiled and took another gulp of his Coke instead. Ralph cleared his throat.
I've got some news, too.
Oh, yeah?
Joe grinned, expecting to hear that Ralph had proposed to Shirley, but the boy's face was solemn.
I got a letter from my mama.
Joe was shocked. As best he knew, Ralph hadn't been in contact with her since he'd run off to the Hopewell place 6 years ago.
How'd she know you here? Reckon one of the men in our gang know her. Told her he thought her son work here.
Ralph stared down at his Coke bottle.
What'd she say?
Ralph nodded without looking up.
She says she's doing good.
Working as a housekeeper.
That good. My stepfather gone.
That real good.
Ralph nodded again.
When I save up enough money, I'm gonna visit her. You know, I ain't ever wanna leave her.
I know. Ralph, I sure she understand.
Ralph looked up at Joe.
He ain't died that day I left. My stepfather. I was worried about that. But he ain't dead. He gone, but not dead.
Ralph's eyes were wide open and vulnerable. Took a gulp of his Coke, and Joe saw that the boy's hand was trembling. Joe tried to make his voice gentle.
That real good, son. He's a good boy, and we all know it.
They drank their Cokes in silence. Chapter 15. After Sam's talk with Anne, he felt awkward around the house and spent even more time with June or Max anywhere besides home. He hadn't eaten dinner with Charlie and Anne in weeks. Though Anne still invited him, he muttered an excuse and went out. Charlie seemed pained by the whole thing, though Sam didn't know what Anne had told him. He was acting overly cheerful, always trying to catch Sam in conversation. His natural warmth turned up in a desperate effort to thaw the frost that had settled over the home. Anne acted as though nothing had happened, which irritated Sam even more. It was another symptom of her properness. Everything just so, perfectly dressed, words all well chosen. Phony. He and June were on their way to the movies one night when they passed Charlie on the boardwalk.
Sam, I'm so glad I ran into you.
Charlie was beaming, which Sam assumed was just more overcompensation for the tension in their domestic situation.
You'll never guess who's in town. Collins.
Artie?
You're kidding.
If Charlie had been the nicest of the graduate students at Princeton, then Artie Collins had been the funniest.
I'm on my way now to Kellerman's house. There's an impromptu gathering. I'd looked for you at home, but you weren't there. This is perfect.
Sam glanced at June.
Well, we were headed to a movie. Artie's an old friend. Would you mind terribly if I went?
She should come.
Oh, I don't want to get in the way.
said June. You go on, I'll be fine.
Nonsense, said Charlie, and Sam wished he wouldn't butt in.
You won't be in the way, and we'd love your company. I won't hear of leaving you behind.
June looked up at Sam, unsure. In truth, he did think she would be in the way, or at least bored by all the physics talk and reminiscing. But after Charlie's enthusiasm, he couldn't tell her not to come. So he nodded, and they followed Charlie. The house was almost identical to Charlie and Anne's, and they could hear laughter coming out before they even got to the door.
That's hearty for you, said Charlie. Got the crowd going already.
Charlie knocked, and someone shouted, Come in! Artie, jacket off and tie askew, sat in the center of a group of seven in the living room. Cab Calloway was singing on a scratchy record somewhere in the background.
Banter and Stone. Now the party can finally begin. How the hell are you, Sam?
Artie shook his hand and patted his back.
Can't complain. What brings you to our fair construction site? Oh, top secret government business, of course. I'm just checking up on you for Oppenheimer.
Robert Oppenheimer was the scientist heading the whole bomb-building project. Sam had known him at Berkeley.
Let me get some more seats, said Kellerman, heading off to the kitchen.
His wife was sitting on the sofa with some other physicists Sam recognized, most of whom worked with Charlie. There was one woman, Dr. Elizabeth Temple, a decent scientist, though not at all attractive.
Who is this?
Asked Artie, extending his hand toward June.
My friend, June Walker, said Sam.
Nice to meet you, said June.
Kellerman returned with chairs and said,
Artie was just telling us about life in New Mexico. Oh, yes, it's quite idyllic. We got horseback riding along the mesas.
Are you doing any physics? Asked Charlie.
Plenty. We're just waiting for our shipments to get in from Oak Ridge so that we can do some experimenting.
Experimenting? Asked Sam.
Let's hope you get it right on the first go.
Cheers to that.
Artie raised his glass of milk. Sam had noticed that the higher up his colleagues were positioned in the operation, the more likely they were to disobey the Army codes of secrecy. Everyone resented having to work in such a scientifically unfriendly fashion and constantly dropped hints to one another.
Presumably you can drink there, at least,
asked someone.
Oppenheimer was famous for his parties at Berkeley, Sam told June. He'd always thought of Oppenheimer as a bit of a kook, really.
Tall and gaunt with large dark eyes, he came from money but put on bohemian affectations. Sam had been shocked when he heard he'd been put in charge of the Manhattan Project.
Lawrence or Compton at the University of Chicago would have made more sense.
Old Oppie has changed. He's a regular slave driver these days. We eat, drink, and sleep the Manhattan Project. There's very little time for anything else. Except horseback riding.
And physics, horseback riding.
Oh, the secrets those mares know. They could end the war before we could if they could just get some U-235 out of Oak Ridge.
Watch yourself, Collins, said Kellerman.
Well, if all the girls here are as pretty as this, then I can see why you may get distracted from the job at hand.
June giggled, and Sam hoped she wasn't too mortified by the attention.
That's enough, Artie, said Kellerman. While you've been trotting around on your ponies, we've been designing, building, and running some of the largest, most complicated facilities the world has ever seen.
Don't let him get to you, Kellerman, said Charlie.
Collins is just jealous of our 24-hour cafeterias and free buses.
The truth was, of course, that every Oak Ridge scientist in the room was green-eyed over Artie's being down there with Oppenheimer, Fermi, Teller, Compton, and Bohr. That was the big show, and they all knew it.
The lunch hall is truly open all night long? Asked Artie.
Truly.
And people work around the clock for your, you know what?
Artie grinned.
Well, what do you know?
I feel a bit hungry now.
A few minutes later, the whole lot of them was headed out to the cafeteria, led on an adventure by Artie, just like at Princeton. By the end of the evening, they had made their way to the canteen, having moved on from the cafeteria. They were sitting around the table, and Artie was telling a story about Sam's falling asleep in their old laboratory, ribbing him in a good-natured way, and everyone laughed.
You keep an eye on this man, June,
Artie said, nudging him.
He can't quite take care of himself.
Sam hung his head in mock shame. Even though he hadn't wanted June to come, Sam was glad that she had. He hoped Charlie would go home tonight and tell Anne all about it. You see, June was capable of holding her own with physicists, he might say. Maybe she hadn't shared her thoughts on Freud, but she had listened and been charming. He wasn't mad to love her after all. Her cheeks were rosy from the beer, and her eyes glowed in the dim electric light as she laughed at Artie's jokes. Sam put his arm around her, feeling happy and protective. The next day at work, he got a phone call asking him to report to a private meeting with Dr. Armstrong. He had the sensation of being called to the principal's office for bad behavior, although Y-12 had been running smoothly as of late. Sam lit a cigarette as he sat down at Dr. Armstrong's desk. Sunlight streamed through the window, forcing the men to squint.
"Well, Cantor."
Armstrong leaned back in his chair, deeply inhaling from his own cigarette.
"I'm going to be leaving you."
Sam wasn't sure how to take this, or even what it meant. Was he leaving Y-12? Oak Ridge? Was he dying?
"I'm sorry to hear that."
Seemed appropriate for any of the possibilities.
"Yes, I'm a bit sorry myself. This crazy place has become dear to me."
He straightened his back, and his voice became more practical. "Anyway, I'm not going far, and I'm sure I'll be in Y-12, periodically.
Actually, I've been promoted, and I'm moving to the main offices. I'll be overseeing work at different sites here, but, of course, most intensely involved with Y-12.
In that case, congratulations."
"Thank you. Now, Cantor, if you're interested, I've discussed it with my superiors, and we think you should be promoted, too."
Sam took the cigarette out of his mouth, surprised.
"You won't be at quite my level. The idea is that you and Hauser will both be given greater responsibilities and will take over my position between the two of you. It's a decision from above. No offense to either of you, but you're not quite senior enough. You know how the Army is about hierarchy. And before you get too excited, let me warn you, it's mostly going to be administrative work. Honestly, we've gotten through the hardest times of getting the place up and running, as I'm sure you realize. They wouldn't be moving me otherwise."
"Of course not." Armstrong leaned forward and stubbed out a cigarette in a large glass ashtray on the desk.
"But that doesn't mean congratulations aren't in order for you, either. You've come by this through your own dedication to Y-12 and practical, innovative thinking. There will be a substantial pay raise, and you will get one of these big offices, as well as the secretary."
"Will Glenda be my secretary?" Sam asked, referring to the matronly blonde currently assisting Dr. Armstrong.
Oh, no. I'm afraid I'm taking Glenda with me."
"But I can't type," June said for the second time.
"Don't worry. I just told him you'd taken a course and that you're overqualified to be working on the Calutrons, which is true."
Her face was pinched with anxiety.
"Maybe, but I can't type."
She was sitting on the edge of his bed, across from him, in the chair.
"Honestly, how hard can it be? You're smart."
"Do you know how?"
Sam had typed plenty of papers in grad school, but had only ever utilized his index fingers in the process.
"Not really, but I can use a typewriter."
She made a whimper and put her head in her hands. He had thought she'd be thrilled at the prospect of getting away from those tedious machines and becoming his secretary, but ever since he'd mentioned the typing test she'd have to take, June had been miserable. He was becoming annoyed.
"You know, I've pulled strings for you. I'm trying to help you."
She gave him a limp smile.
"I know. Thank you, honey."
He came over to the bed and put his arm around her, which inevitably led to kissing. Before it led to anything more, she gently pushed him away.
"Anne's here, isn't she?" June whispered.
Sam let out something between a sigh and a moan. Of course, Anne was there, so they mustn't. Goddamn Anne. He released June and lay back flat on the bed. This evening wasn't going anything like he planned. He wanted to celebrate his promotion with June. He thought she'd be thrilled about his arranging this interview for her, too, but instead she was just worrying herself sick over it. His head was beginning to ache. June stroked the back of his hand with her fingers.
"You hungry?"
"Not really."
"I'm starved. Why don't we walk over to the cafeteria? You'll work up an appetite on the way."
She stood and straightened her skirt. He got up slowly, still with half a mind to stay in bed, but he didn't want to upset her. He collected his jacket and hat from the desk and began putting them on.
"I don't understand it," he said, opening the door for her. "You're usually so optimistic about things. I thought you'd be thrilled for this opportunity."
"Honestly, Sam, I am thrilled. I'm just nervous, too, you know?"
I wish I knew how to type. The smell of cooking meat wafted from the kitchen. Anne was sitting on the living room sofa, reading Time.
Hello, June. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks. And you?
Fine. Sam ignored her, as per usual these days, and continued toward the door.
I'm sure we can find someone to teach you, he continued.
Do you know anyone with a typewriter?
I have a portable typewriter, Anne interposed.
Sam stopped in front of the door. She was beaming at them from the sofa, the magazine laid across her lap.
Really?